Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at a mysterious group of animals that included some of the heaviest, tallest, and fiercest creatures to ever walk the planet, dinosaurs.
So there are just so many questions about dinosaurs. They're such an amazing group of animals. So I don't where do we even start with them?
Well, what are dinosaurs?
That's actually an excellent question. What are dinosaurs? So dinosaurs, this is a group of animals that first appeared during the Triassic period, which was about 230 million years ago, and they were around for approximately 165 million years. And dinosaurs were actually first described by scientists in the 19th century. And they divided them into two groups based on their pelvic shape. This is the dinosaurs, not the scientists. So first there are the saurischian dinosaurs, and that means lizard-hipped. And this includes sauropods. And sauropods, of course, are the
biggest dinosaurs to ever walk the earth, right?
Right. Those are the dinosaurs that they're the herbivores that
the long-necked dinosaurs,
long necks, long tails, and walked on four legs. And the theropods, which were bipedal.
Like T-Rex.
Right, bipedal carnivorous dinosaurs, mostly carnivorous. And then the other group, based on pelvic shape, is the ornithischian dinosaurs, which they had a backward-facing pelvis. And now this little bit is confusing because ornithischian, it actually means bird-hipped. But in fact, the dinosaurs that gave rise to birds are not in this group. The ornithischians includes ceratopsians, and those are the dinosaurs like Triceratops, the ones with the big horns. The horns and the big frills.
And the ankylosaurs, which are the dinosaurs with the armor on their backs, and they were the four-legged.
Right, and the big club-like tails, and they usually had armored helmets. The stegosaurs, those are the ones that had the spikes or the shields going down their backs.
And then the duck-billed dinosaurs, which had the cool heads.
Right. They duck-billed dinosaurs, yeah, they had faces that looked somewhat duck-like, and some of them also had just these big crests, right. And dinosaurs lived all over the world, including Antarctica.
And I think we have to remember that Antarctica, at least that long ago, was not as cold. It was warmer climes, and it was part of a bigger supercontinent.
Right. It wasn't this frozen desert that it is now. And some dinosaurs lived alongside swimming marine reptiles like the plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs, and also alongside flying reptiles like pterosaurs. However,
okay. So these are always shown in pictures and artwork with dinosaurs,
but they are not dinosaurs. They are part of a larger group called archosaurs. But I know, and this makes me bonkers when you get those tubes of plastic
They're
dinosaur
constantly.
Toys and they have plesiosaurs in there and they have pterosaurs in there because those are not dinosaurs.
And it's really hard to sort of distinguish them because they've been grouped with dinosaurs so often. So.
Right, but dinosaurs were land animals. So there were some dinosaurs that became capable of flight, but those were feathered dinosaurs.
Right.
And so some recent discoveries have shown that there were types of dinosaurs that had these membrane-like wings.
And oh, they could glide.
We're going to talk a little bit about those later, but they were not pterosaurs. Pterosaurs were an entirely different group. Pterosaurs were not dinosaurs.
And that is not a mystery. They were not dinosaurs.
There's no mystery. There's no mystery about that. Pterosaurs are definitely not dinosaurs. So, and from the very first time that dinosaurs were discovered, people were fascinated by them. They're huge. Dinosaurs represent some of the biggest land animals that ever lived.
And they were also fierce. Seeing descriptions of these dinosaurs tearing into other humongous animals and stalking Earth. They had huge heads, massive jaws, and
I can't imagine what it must have been like to find a pterosaur skull. Like to see a pterosaur skull for the first time and see something that had just these enormous teeth and these powerful jaws and just something at the scale that was unheard of in predators that are alive today.
And dinosaurs weren't just one shape or one size. There were so many dinosaurs and some of them were really weird dinosaurs.
Yeah. So the ankylosaurs, right? So you have these helmet heads, you've got clubs for tails, you've got this big armored body. and then the duck-billed hadrosaurs and the neck frills on the ceratopsians, and you've got the long necks and the long tails on the sauropods, and then
you have T-Rex, which had a big head and these tiny little arms, and
yeah,
which they're learning might have been able to do something. They may have been functional arms.
So, right. But when you first look at a T-Rex, like if you look at a mounted skeleton of a T-Rex, and you see this enormous head and then these tiny, tiny little arms.
It works so well in cartoons, though.
Well, yes. It makes them seem kind of adorable and charming.
So dinosaurs are also mysterious because they went extinct millions of years ago, before humans even appeared on Earth.
Right.
So how do we know all of this about them? How do we know when they lived, what they were, what species they belonged to?
Well, the first clues that dinosaurs existed at all were in the bones that were discovered. And fossils of skeletons and skulls that are still being found and reconstructed today are giving scientists even more information about just this diverse world of animals. And then of course, in addition to the skeletal reconstructions, paleo artists work with paleontologists to basically create models and illustrations of what these dinosaurs may have looked like in life. So based on information from the bones about what the muscle groups may have been,
right,
and based on what's known about animals that are alive today in terms of their biomechanics and how they move and what types of skin covering they have and
whether they had preserved feathers or even
right,
melanosomes, whether they had pigments, you know, to look at what colors these dinosaurs might have been.
Well, that's actual evidence that artists can draw from to recreate what colors animals may have been. But even when they don't have those clues, what they can do is they can look at animal groups today and they can see, okay, well, you know, just looking at reptiles and seeing just and amphibians and seeing the range of colors in the skin of frogs and lizards gives you some idea of, like, because I think early reconstructions of dinosaurs, they were all sort of grayish green.
Right.
But if you look at the animal, you know, if you look at animals that are alive today and you look at just the incredible range and diversity of colors and patterns, that it's very reasonable to assume that same kind of colorful diversity existed in dinosaurs, and that different colors may have helped dinosaurs to select their mates. It may have helped them to differentiate between species. It may have served as warnings to warn off predators, and these are things that paleo artists are really, really helping to bring to life, and often working just from the bones themselves and from references to live animals,
and then figuring out sort of how these dinosaurs behaved. Some of the things that paleontologists look to are the footprints, the trackways, and to see, you know, did they hunt in groups, which scientists did show pack hunting in a group of Canadian tyrannosaurs, and that was from trackways found there.
Right, trackways and footprints are actually some of my favorite types of fossils, because it's like a snapshot of the living foot. So when you're looking at the bones of a dinosaur, obviously you're just seeing what was inside it when it was alive. But if you look at trackways or a footprint, you're seeing an impression of the foot of a living animal.
That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah. And then of course, so you know, you have individual footprints, and then you have things like trackways, where you actually, you know, it's a set of tracks made by an individual animal, or in some cases groups of animals. And yeah, that can tell you a lot about how the animal may have walked, and it can tell you stuff about social behavior, because if you see groups of the same type of dinosaur that all made tracks at the same time, that suggests that they were all moving together. If you see tracks of adults and young dinosaurs and juveniles together, that suggests that there was parental care.
These are some really cute findings.
Right. There have been sites that have been found in Argentina. There are beaches that were essentially nesting grounds for dinosaurs. So not just, you know, so in addition to bones and trackways, you also get these preserved nest sites. And sometimes there are preserved eggs with embryos that are still inside. And in fact, there was actually this one sort of groundbreaking find from years ago showed brooding behavior. So it was a dinosaur called Oviraptor, and it was given the name Big Mama because it was found in a position on top of a group of eggs in a nest, and it was brooding them, and it looked very, very much like a bird. So they called it Big Mama. And actually, it's interesting because at first, when paleontologists found that fossil, they thought that it was a predator, and they just assumed that because it was not thought that dinosaurs were caring parents. And so at first it was thought that this dinosaur was actually, you know, was actually preying on the eggs. But then it was
caring for them.
Right. But then later, that, you know, when paleontologists took, you know, looked more closely at the posture, they realized that it was very similar to that of birds that are sitting on a nest. So there's actually stuff that can be learned about dinosaur behavior from fossils. Now, when we talk about dinosaurs being alive today, in pop culture terms, that there have been movies about dinosaurs or dinosaur-like monsters living at the center of the Earth or in remote jungles or in the ocean or even in lakes.
Right? Yeah, we have our favorites at Live Science: Nessie in Loch Ness and Champ in Lake Champlain.
So there have been sightings. sightings, yeah, right. So, but actually, in reality, living dinosaurs are much closer than that.
We just have to look out our window, really.
Right. You can find them out your window. You can find them on the sidewalk. You can find them in your backyard. You can find them on your dinner table. And, of course, we're talking about
birds.
About birds, exactly. So ancestors of modern birds were theropod dinosaurs, which is that group of three-toed bipedal and mostly carnivorous dinosaurs that also includes Velociraptor and T-Rex.
So for today's first mystery, we look at our feathered friends and ask the question, are birds still considered to be dinosaurs?
And the short answer to that is yes. Birds are dinosaurs in the same way that humans are mammals. So the earliest birds shared a lot in common with their theropod relatives, including feathers and egg laying. So those are a couple of things that are generally thought if you think about what makes a bird. But there are certain traits that separated ancient birds from other theropods and eventually came to define the modern bird lineage today.
So what makes a bird a bird?
Okay, well, there are two traits that are generally associated with birds today, right? So it's feathers and egg laying.
But other animals lay eggs, so not just birds, right?
Right. So looking at eggs, you've got reptiles lay eggs, amphibians, fish. So what that means is that this is an ancestral trait that actually all of these groups of animals, including birds, get from an older common ancestor. So this isn't something that originated with dinosaurs.
Right. So birds also have feathers. Is that's one of the traits that links them to dinosaurs, or that's distinct?
Well, feathers is something that is associated only with birds today, but many non-avian dinosaurs, and those are dinosaurs that are not part of the bird group, have feathers. And scientists have even recently found that there are two ornithischian dinosaurs, which are not even in the same dinosaur group as the theropods, where birds came from. Even though they're the bird hip dinosaurs, that is not the group that includes birds. So as far as feathers are concerned, with more and more discoveries that have been coming out of the fossil record in recent decades, scientists are beginning to see that feathers are much more widespread than was initially thought, and it wasn't just birds that evolved feathers. In fact, this evolved many times in dinosaurs. So looking at birds, modern birds have feathered tails and bodies, but there are other physical features that are particular to birds, such as unfused shoulder bones.
And they have toothless beaks.
Mm-hmm, right.
And they also have their forelimbs are longer than their hind limbs.
Mm-hmm. And then they have this bony plate near their tails, which is called a pygostyle. So many extinct theropods had one or more of these, but only modern birds have all of them.
Right.
And then this is interesting. In 2019, researchers described a primitive bird from Japan called Fucopteryx. And so at 120 million years old, this is the earliest known bird with a pygostyle. And the researcher, I spoke to the researcher, and he told me that it actually closely resembles the pygostyle of a chicken.
Oh, how cool.
Right. So this is a feature that you see in birds today that was also something that was found in some of the earliest known birds.
So if we look back, because to try to trace this sort of lineage, what did the early birds look like? Were they more dinosaur looking?
Oh, definitely. The very earliest birds were very dinosaur like compared to modern birds. Some of them had long reptilian tails. Some of them had many of them had teeth and they had in the early birds, the bones in their hands hadn't fused yet, so they had like these fingers with claws on them.
So they did look like sort of a dino bird sort of mix. We know that the theropod is the branch that led to birds today,
right.
But how do you distinguish between those theropods and other theropods?
Well, researchers, what they do is they make all of those. Once you started seeing all of those physical features, that was when you were clearly on the path to modern birds. But what researchers do when they look at earlier evolutions within the bird lineage, they make these very precise precise measurements of subtle shapes in the fossilized bones, and this includes bumps and bulges on the bones that are related to the organization of muscle groups. And then what they do is they crunch all of this data to create algorithms that and these algorithms help them distinguish between different animal groups, and that's what distinguishes birds from other theropods. So it's not just the bones that they're looking at. They're also looking at the emergence of certain types of muscles that supported powered flight, because that's something else that emerged as something that is particular to birds, even though obviously not all birds that are alive today can fly.
So they had these large, powerful forelimbs and these muscles that allowed them to lift their bodies off the ground. And you're saying that dinosaurs, or the theropods that are not the theropods that are birds.
Right, the non-avian dinosaurs.
They didn't have all of these traits together. So that group of theropods went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous period.
Right, so at the end of the Cretaceous, all the non-avian dinosaurs died out. And then the avian theropods, those are the ones that continued to evolve and to diversify and to develop more specialized flight features, such as there's an elongated structure in their breastbones that's called a keel, and powerful pectoral muscles attached to the keel and power the downstroke. So powered flight is also something that's recognized as being part of the evolutionary track of what modern birds are.
And do scientists know what this first bird was? Have they found that?
Yes. It's a theropod called Archaeopteryx, and that means ancient wing. And Archaeopteryx lived around 150 million years ago in what is now southern Germany, and weighed about 2 pounds or 1 kilogram, and measured about 20 inches or 50 centimeters in length.
So it was small.
It was a little guy.
And I assume it was covered in feathers.
The fossils in this case actually show that preserved feathers its tail and body. Yeah, I know the preservation in some of these is just incredible. And also the shape of the forelimbs and the shape of the feathers themselves also suggest that Archaeopteryx was able to fly. But it was probably just like, you know, simple flapping flight for short distances, not long distance flying.
And how many of these dinosaurs are around today? Like, if we were to say dinosaurs are living, birds are dinosaurs.
Yes, they are. And so that means that there are 10,000 dinosaur species that are around worldwide. So from seagulls to the boardwalk to the turkey on your Thanksgiving table, birds still belong to the same group of theropod dinosaurs that hatched Archaeopteryx 150 million years ago. So, Gina, I think it's pretty safe to say that you and I, as reporters, editors at Live Science, we're science geeks. We're curious about science, and we love
to learn.
We do. And I think it's also safe to say that our listeners at Life's Little Mysteries also love to learn, and that's why they're tuning in to listen to us. So this is why we think our listeners will really enjoy a streaming service called The Great Courses Plus. They have thousands of lectures with experts who are world-renowned educators and award-winning educators from institutions around the world.
And plenty of topics.
So everything from the sciences to history to philosophy to
Photography,
you know, like personal hobbies. So there's definitely something there for anybody who wants to learn about pretty much anything.
And one of the neat things about The Great Courses is that there's an app that goes with it.
Right. And so with the app, you're not tied to your desktop. You can watch these lectures on your mobile device, and you can actually choose between listening to audio or watching a video, and you can actually jump back and forth between them.
The streaming service allows you to download courses, which to me is perfect for a commute if you're going on a plane trip.
Right. It's like a classroom in your pocket all the time. There are so many courses, it's hard to choose just one. But one that did stand out to me was The Inexplicable Universe. There are a lot of big questions about the universe, and this series does such a great job of taking these big, complex ideas and breaking them down in a way that is just easy to understand, but also gives you a deeper dive if you want it.
And Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the one who leads these courses.
Right, he's the host of these lectures.
Right, and he just has a sort of magical way of making just about anything engaging and interesting.
Was there a particular lecture that you enjoyed watching?
So I love the spooky universe.
And
you know, it was a lot about, you know, some particle physics and basic physics. And I know a lot about this stuff because I edit Live Science.
Right.
But I found I was so intrigued and learned so much. For instance, I did not know that The proton was discovered in 1911 by Ernest Rutherford.
I did not know that either.
And if all of this sounds like something you'd be interested in, we have some good news.
We have a special offer for listeners of Life's Little Mysteries. For a limited time only, The Great Courses Plus is offering our listeners an entire month for free. But to start your free month trial, you must sign up today using a special URL.
And the URL is thegreatcoursesplus.com/LLM.
And that's LLM for Life's Little Mysteries.
So thegreatcoursesplus.com/LLM, and you can get an entire month for free.
One dinosaur is a whole lot bigger than your average bird, and that is, of course, the towering T-Rex. But even the giant T-Rex had small beginnings. As hatchlings, they were not only tiny, they may even have been covered with downy feathers. And as teenagers, T-Rex was only about 6 feet tall. And I guess that's still pretty intimidating. And recently, scientists described a pair of fossil skeletons that were previously thought to be a type of pygmy tyrannosaur, but they turned out to be T-Rex teens. Here to talk to us about that is Dr. Holly Woodward, a paleontologist and an associate professor of anatomy with the Center for Health Sciences at Ohio State University. Dr. Woodward, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
To start, why don't you tell me about the paleontology research that you do?
Sure. I'm a paleohistologist, so I look at bone tissue microstructure within a fossil bone using a microscope to try to understand how an extinct animal like a dinosaur lived and grew.
Let's talk about T-Rex. In general, what is known about the life cycle of a T-Rex? What do they look like when they're babies, and how long does it take them to become mature adults?
Sure. So we really don't know much about how T-Rex grew up. We haven't ever found definitive eggs or embryos or hatchlings or, you know, pretty much anything, you know, dog-sized or smaller. So we really don't know what T-Rex looked like or how fast it grew when it was little. So the smallest specimens we have are, you know, maybe donkey size or zebra sized for comparison. The oldest specimen we have that has been aged is the famous specimen called Sue, and it was in its mid-20s when it died.
I know that there were also some scars or some damage to the skeleton that told paleontologists how Sue may have lived. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. So one of the injuries to Sue is on its lower leg, and it had broken one of the bones, and then the bone had rehealed. So we know that it was possible for these dinosaurs to injure themselves, but get along enough or well enough after that to continue to survive. So that means that it would have been able to still find food or procure food on its own. And then usually on older, larger dinosaurs like that, you'll find many instances of broken bones, particularly ribs, that have knitted at odd angles. So dinosaurs, it seems, lived a pretty rough life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. When you look at mounted skeletons, it can be hard to imagine how these animals may have looked when they were alive. So as a paleontologist, what do you see when you look at these bones? What are the clues that help you piece together what these animals may have looked like in life?
So one of the things we can look for up close are muscle scars on the bones. Where muscles insert on bones, they leave rough patches because muscles are essentially tugging against the bone there. And so the size of those rough patches or muscle scars can tell us how large the muscles were that attached there. You know, the bigger the scar, the more robust the muscle. So by looking at different muscle attachment sites on the legs, on the back of the head, on the tail, you can see or infer what kind of muscle sizes the animal had. And then you can infer, you know, was this a powerful contracting muscle allowing fast movement? You know, was it a big bulky tail? So you can start literally fleshing out the dinosaur just by looking at the attachment sites.
And how exactly have new perspectives or technologies helped paleontologists to update the way dinosaurs were first described decades ago, or in some cases, more than 100 years ago?
One of the big things right now is digital scanning. So that's one of the, the most cutting edge techniques that we can use, not only, you know, CT scanning the bones itself, but, you know, laser 3D scanning bones, and then you can digitally reconstruct the animal. You can connect parts of bones pretty easily on a computer without having to, you know, make an armature for it and actually mount the specimen in real life. So it helps us put together the specimen in a more fluid way. And by doing that, we can actually very easily digitize muscle attachments and, you know, flesh out the or round out the size of the abdomen and the rib cage and get a pretty decent view of the size of the animal digitally, which is a whole lot easier than trying to do it, you know, on a full-size specimen.
All right. How about teenage T-Rexes, Jane and Petey? You were the lead author of a study about them last year. Tell me about the backstory here. When Jane and Petey were first found, they were thought to be pygmy tyrannosaurs. Why is that?
When they were first found, they were found in the early 2000s. And at that point, a lot of research had been done on Tyrannosaurus rex and its ontogeny or how it grew up. But as I said, we don't really have small specimens of T-Rex. And the specimens we did have, the scientists were looking primarily at the skull, but other bones as well, to see how the skull changed as T-Rex got older. And most of the tyrannosaur researchers agreed at that point that these small pygmy tyrannosaurs were most likely T-Rex and not a separate species called Nanotyrannus. And so in the early 2000s, when Jane and Petey were found, most T-Rex researchers at that point assigned them to juvenile T-Rex, although others were still adamant that these were Nanotyrannus or the pygmy Tyrannosaurus rex.
And then what was the evidence you described in the study that more definitively identified them as teenage T-Rexes?
So since the first skull of one of these small tyrannosaur specimens, the pygmy-sized tyrannosaurs, was found in the 40s, basically scientists had been going back and forth as to what this thing is. It had been named and renamed several times throughout the decades. And then in the late 1980s is when it was assigned the genus Nanotyrannus. So most of the argument had been based on morphological features. So skull shape, how the bones looked compared to a T-Rex. And so there were basically two camps, you know, how much difference between these smaller tyrannosaur skulls and a large Sioux-sized skull was enough to call it something different versus how much of it is actually just what you expect from something that's going from, you know, the size of a pigeon when it hatches to 40 feet long. So most of the debate then was morphological. This skull shape means it's a new species. This skull shape means it's a juvenile. And what we did was take a look at the histology of Jane and Petey by looking inside the leg bones. So we looked at the femur and the tibia in cross-section, which means we had to cut a piece of the bone out of the middle of the bone shaft, and we polished it down so thin that you could pass light through it. And at that point, you can use a microscope and look at the internal bone structure, which is really cool for me because if you look at bone in this way from any modern animal, it looks just the same. You see the same structures. You see the blood vessel canals. You see the bone cells. And you see the bone fibers. So because you see all these same features, bone fibers, the blood vessels, the bone cells, you can infer that if you see these features in a modern animal and you know how it lived and grew, and you see those same features in something like Jane or Petey, then you can infer that they were growing in a similar way. And one of the really cool things that we can do with this type of histological research is recognize whether or not an animal has reached adult size. Because an adult animal preserves a particular kind of bone tissue when it stops growing. So in modern animals, everything that stops growing after it reaches adult size has this kind of tissue. And we didn't see that in Jane or Petey. We actually saw rapidly growing tissue, something you would expect from a juvenile. So we then independently demonstrated that Jane and Petey are juveniles of something. And because T-Rex is the only definitive tyrannosaur from that time period, we make the parsimonious conclusion that they're juvenile T-Rex.
So I'm curious, what are the features in a skeleton that tell you if a T-Rex is male or female?
The only thing that we've been able to find so far that tells us whether it's a male or female is something called medullary bone. And it's a particular type of spongy, fast-growing tissue that you find lining the marrow cavity. And modern birds have this, and only the females, naturally, and only during the period in which they are shelling their eggs internally and a little bit after they lay their eggs. So it's a very ephemeral tissue. It's not there all the time. But if because birds descended from dinosaurs, it's reasonable to infer that dinosaurs might have also had this tissue. And back in the early 2000s, the first discovery of medullary bone in a T-Rex was made. And it looks very, very similar to what you see in modern birds. And so it was inferred that this particular T-Rex died while it was pregnant. So the only way you can really tell male from female is if you happen to have a female shelling its eggs or had just laid its eggs and then it died.
And then what are some of the big outstanding questions related to T-Rexes or other types of dinosaurs that you're hoping to solve over the next 5 to 10 years?
I would like to try to understand how much individual variation there was within dinosaur populations, and in particular, in this case, Tyrannosaurus rex, because when we looked at the bone tissue microstructure of Jane and Petey, we saw these growth rings in the bone, which you normally expect. The dinosaur stops growing once a year and puts down rings, just like you see in a tree. We know this because animals today do the same thing, and they deposit these rings. But the rings in the Tyrannosaur individuals were oddly spaced. So sometimes the rings were close together, meaning there wasn't much growth in one year. Other times the rings were spread more further apart, meaning there was more growth. And so what you expect and what you see in a lot of modern animals is just fast growth when you're young and a little plateau when you're getting older. And then it sort of levels off completely when you're an adult. But it seems like T-Rex was able to track the resource abundance. And so if it wasn't getting much to eat, it just didn't grow. If it was having a really great year, it grew a lot. And the cool thing is there are other dinosaurs where this trend has been reported. So it's not just T-Rex. Other dinosaurs are doing this too. And it would be really cool to try to figure out how they were doing this. Was this something enabling plasticity in the population? So you might have a little T-Rex when they get to be an adult because they just couldn't get much to eat. Did everything sort of catch up and end up the same size? And I think most importantly, if there's this much plasticity and growth, could this have been some kind of driver for speciation?
I've been talking to Dr. Holly Woodard. You can find out more about her work by reading the Live Science article, 6-foot-tall T-Rex skeletons, not a new pygmy species, just teenagers, and by following her on Twitter at HistoHolly. Links are in the show notes. Dr. Woodard, thanks so much for talking to me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We have a lot more dinosaur mysteries that we're going to dig up very soon. But first, we want to tell you about How It Works, the action-packed magazine bursting with exciting information about science and technology.
In How It Works, fascinating articles cover a wide range of topics with amazing illustrations and photos that bring science and technology to life. You'll learn something new every month, and it's great for all ages and for the whole family.
In the latest issue, How It Works takes a look at what will soon be the world's biggest telescope, the Square Kilometer Array Project.
And so is this telescope built yet?
No. It's still under construction. When completed, it will be the world's biggest radio telescope.
Okay, so it'll be measuring radio waves from objects in space.
Right. So that's radio astronomy is measuring radio emissions. And what that means is that radio telescopes, compared to certain other kinds, can make observations of very faint signals from very distant objects.
And so how big will this array be, and where are they building it?
Well, the fact that it's an array means that it's a network of many telescopes that are all working together. And there will be two main locations in Australia and South Africa, and then other smaller installations spread out over an area the size of a continent, about 1 million square miles. So it's big, really big.
And what's the goal? What's the big goal of this huge project?
It's It's such a big goal. It's bringing together 100,000 antenna with a collecting area of about 1 square kilometer each to probe radio waves from the early universe. And this array is going to be 50 times more sensitive and 10,000 times faster at surveying the sky than any other telescope.
And it will look for the formation of the first stars, the very first stars to form, and black holes, and during a stage that's called the cosmic dark ages.
Right. And it could even look for signs of radio signals produced by potentially intelligent alien civilizations on distant worlds.
When can we expect it to be done?
Well, it's still a little ways off. It won't be operational until 2027.
Interesting. Another giant telescope, the 30-meter telescope, also has its sights set high. This observatory.
Now, this is an observatory that we wrote about recently on Live Science.
Right.
And it's been in the news, not so much, well, partly for its size, but more for its location recently.
Right. So this observatory, when it is built, or if it is built, will be 12 times sharper than Hubble, or the famous Hubble Space Telescope. But there have been some protests about where this telescope is being built.
Right. The location of it is somewhat problematic.
The construction has been approved on the dormant Mauna Kea volcano, but this is a sacred site. And it is the highest point in the Hawaiian Islands, and so that's great for the observatory. But it's also a place that the native Hawaiians take very seriously. It has a spiritual past for them.
Mm-hmm. So, and as we see, you know, projects like this are, you know, years and sometimes decades in the planning and in the execution. And in this case, it's been contentious for some time.
Right. And the native groups there say that they weren't sufficiently consulted in the planning on this, what they call the land of the gods. And they feel that if they can't have a say in this project, then there's not much they can protect in the future.
Right. And there are going to be some, you know, there are environmental impacts to building a telescope of this size as well.
In January, at the American Astronomical Society meeting, Hawaiian researchers were actually joined to this protest and protesting the construction, and they were trying to ensure that no federal money is going to be used to build it on state land without consent of the local indigenous people. So we'll see how that goes. You can find out more about everyday mysteries of science and technology and how it works. Subscribe today to save over 80% and get 3 issues for just $3 or £3. Visit myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/how20 and search for How It Works.
Plus, exclusively for listeners of Life's Little Mysteries, you can get 2 free ebooks worth $40 when you subscribe. Get the Book of Dogs and Canines and the book Big Cats and African Wildlife delivered straight to your email, absolutely free. Just visit myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/how20 and search for How It Works.
You can also visit Live Science to read more about the controversial construction of the Mauna Kea telescope. The link is in the show notes.
Those telescopes are pretty big, but you know what else was pretty big?
Dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs! The biggest land animals to ever live were dinosaurs. But not all were big. Some were smaller than a pigeon.
Our next mystery looks at dinosaur extremes. What were the world's biggest and smallest dinosaurs?
Obviously, the rock stars of the dinosaur world and, you know, of natural history museums tend to be the biggest skeletons. You know, people want to see the giant Apatosaurus or the enormous T-Rex. And, you know, they're for good reason. They're very impressive looking.
But how would paleontologists define biggest?
This is actually kind of a more difficult question than you'd think for dinosaurs. You know, does it mean longest? You know, like the longest dinosaur from the nose tip to the tail tip? Does it mean the tallest? Does it mean the heaviest? And it also can be complicated because sometimes paleontologists just find individual bones and not complete skeletons. And then they have to estimate the height and the weight from that. So there's a sauropod called Amphicelius, which is sometimes cited as the longest, the tallest, and the heaviest. But here's the thing. It's known only from a sketch of a single vertebrae in a notebook from the 19th century paleontologist Edward Drinker Cope. And the bone itself was lost or destroyed or maybe never even existed. And anyway, there's no other evidence for it. So for many paleontologists, that dinosaur cannot be held up as the biggest anything.
But today, paleontologists probably look to Diplodocus or
Mamenchisaurus.
As the longest dinosaurs. They're slender sauropod dinosaurs, and they're known from pretty complete skeletons. They were more than
reasonably complete. Yeah,
they're more than 100 feet long. So these were, you know, bigger than a couple school buses put together.
Right. And then the tallest is probably a dinosaur called Giraffatitan, which is another sauropod dinosaur that stood about 40 feet tall, around 12 meters. And it lived in the late Jurassic around 150 million years ago in what is now Tanzania. But the exact height would depend on what the maximum neck extension of this dinosaur was. And so even though paleontologists, they can take the fossil skeleton of a dinosaur like this and they can assemble it, you know, they don't have the ligaments. They don't know
the articulation, how the bones sort of fit together.
Well, they know how the bones fit together, but as far as like how high the dinosaur could actually
soft tissue
lift its neck.
Too. Yeah.
Right. So if you look at animals that have long necks, they can usually lift their necks up to a certain point, but not beyond that.
Right.
And even if they can lift it beyond that, you know, they maybe can't hold it in that position that long. So there's a lot of debate among the paleontologist community about these long-necked sauropods is how high could they actually lift their necks. And so there's been some work based on, again, looking at animals that are alive today and looking at, you know, just what is known from how long-necked animals work and how the ligaments work in animals like that. But it's hard to say, you know, with precision what the extreme limits would have been for how high Giraffatitan could have lifted up its neck.
How about the heaviest dinosaurs?
Well, the way that they calculate weight, because obviously, you know, when you only have the bones to work with, you have to estimate what the body mass would have been from that. So one way to measure is to measure the minimum circumference of the humerus, which is the upper arm bone or the front leg, and the femur, which is the thigh bone. And then you plug the measurements of these weight-supporting bones into a formula, and what that does is that can get you the animal's mass. So basically what they're doing is they're reverse engineering the animal by looking at, okay, these bones were able to support X amount of weight. And so if you have the two biggest bones in the body, which are, you know, the weight-bearing bones, then they can calculate from that how much weight those bones would have been holding up.
And so there are a few contenders for the heaviest. And so most likely Argentinosaurus, which is a type of titanosaur.
And that's
a giant
sauropod.
Right.
Titanosaurs, as you can guess, you know, they were the titanic sauropods. They were massive.
And this Argentinosaurus lived in Argentina, and scientists think it weighed between about 77 tons at the minimum and up to 110 tons or 70 metric tons to 100 metric tons.
But it's hard.
A lot of assumptions go into that range and that estimate.
Right. So you've got, you know, like between 77 tons and 110 tons. And the reason why there's so much uncertainty is because it's only known from 13 bones. So now this includes a tibia, a shin bone, a rib fragment, and five fragmentary hip vertebra, and then six mid-back vertebra. So you'll notice that does not include the big load-bearing bones.
Right, the femur.
Right. Now, there actually is a femur, like an Argentinosaurus femur, that is sometimes included, but because it was found 15 kilometers away from the other bones.
They don't know if that was from this Argentinosaurus.
It might belong to a different animal, right. So it was found in sort of the same area, so it's sometimes included in estimates of, you know, what this animal's weight may have been, but it's also likely that because it was so far away that it didn't even belong to this animal at all.
I mean, it's incredible, an incredible feat to be able to take these fragments, not even full bones, full single bones, but fragments, and to come up with what dinosaur it belonged to and then come up with these weight estimates.
I think this is part of why the subject of dinosaurs is something that's so fascinating, you know, both to paleontologists and also to non-scientists, because there's a lot of imagination that's involved. At the same time, I mean, obviously you're looking at data and you're looking at scientific measurements and you're looking at information that all has to piece together, but it's just like it's this fascinating puzzle.
To bring it all together to form these reconstructions, these estimates, you know, what this dinosaur was like when it lived.
Right, right. But because there's so much about them that, you know, we can't see firsthand, it just opens the door for your imagination, right? And so I think there's something about that appeals to a lot of people. And I think that's why for kids in particular,
yeah,
dinosaurs are they just find dinosaurs so fascinating.
My 5-year-old can watch these dinosaur digs, literally watch them dig up dinosaurs, because they then put the reconstruction and show what that dinosaur may have looked like, so another contender for the heaviest dinosaurs.
Right.
It's not just Argentinosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
There's another dinosaur because they, you know, all of these dinosaurs, they're all estimates. But Patagotitan is another titanosaur, and this one's also from Argentina.
Right, right.
And this one may have weighed 69 tons, which
right.
seems pretty exact.
But but this weight was calculated based on a composite of six different individuals. So they're all Patagotitans, but there were six different Patagotitans.
And who knows how old, you know, how where in the life cycle they were, right?
I think that they were able to, because of just based on the size and the shape of the bones, I think, you know, they were fairly confident that these were from animals that were around the same age or at least were, you know, were adults. But again, it's, you don't get the same level of precision that you would get if you know for a fact that you're working with the bones from a single individual.
And do scientists have any of the weight-bearing bones from one of these heavyweights?
Well, there's the heaviest known dinosaur that has a humerus and a femur bone from the same individual is, I love this name, Dreadnoughtus.
Oh,
so
wow.
This is, Dreadnoughtus lived 77 million years ago, weighed 65 tons, and was another Argentinian titanosaur. And so that is the heaviest known dinosaur where you actually have those two of the heavy weight-bearing bones.
To put that into perspective, an African elephant weighs between 2.5 and 7 tons. I mean,
right.
we're talking about 65 tons.
You'd have to stack a lot of elephants.
Enormous.
Yeah.
What about the other extreme?
The other extreme is the smallest dinosaurs. Well, that would actually be a hummingbird, Gina, because
birds are dinosaurs.
Birds are dinosaurs, right. So, and the smallest hummingbird, of course, is the bee hummingbird, which is found only in Cuba. And they're so small that they're often mistaken for bees. They measure just about 2 inches or 5 centimeters long, and they weigh less than 2 grams.
How cute. So what about extinct dinosaurs?
Ah, okay.
Small extinct dinosaurs, not birds.
Right. I know. You sometimes, just because, you know, the big dinosaurs are kind of, you know, they're the ones that get most of the attention. So, but there were plenty of smaller dinosaurs. And so in extinct dinosaurs, there was a dinosaur that was discovered in 2007 that measured about 2 feet or 70 centimeters long, and it was called Mahakala omnigove. And it lived about 80 million years ago. And then there was another small Cretaceous dinosaur that had a much, much bigger name. It's, okay, wait a second. I have to say this in my head a couple of times. Micropachycephalosaurus.
I think that's actually the longest dinosaur name. I'm almost
positive. Oh, is it? That,
yeah.
That would not surprise me.
So smallest dinosaur, longest name.
Right, right. So micro, of course, means small. The pachycephalosaurs, those are the dinosaurs that had the, you know,
the
thick helmeted heads. Yeah. So this was a thick-headed plant eater that also measured about 2 feet or 70 centimeters in length.
Those were the smallest extinct dinosaurs?
No, there were dinosaurs that were even smaller than that. So there's a dinosaur called Ichi, which is a feathered dinosaur from China. And this is, earlier I mentioned that there were recent discoveries of dinosaurs that had membraned wings like a bat. Ichi was one of those dinosaurs. So this little weirdo weighed about 13 ounces and had a wingspan of 23 inches. But instead of having feathered wings, it actually had these membranes, these membranes of skin, very much like
a bat.
And it was probably used them for gliding.
And so that's about the size of like a pigeon. So that's pretty small.
That is pretty small, but it's also not the only one, because even more recently, scientists found another bat-winged dinosaur that was a close relative of Ichi's, but was nearly half its size. And this one was found in northeastern China, measured about 13 inches long and weighed maybe 11 ounces. And
I'll let you pronounce that name.
Oh, God, do I have to pronounce that one? Okay. I'm not – now, this one I'm not sure of. I believe it's Ambopteryx longibrachium.
Awesome.
Okay. And that was reported in May 2019 in the journal Nature.
And another little itty-bitty dinosaur that was just under 12 inches long was a flightless feathered dinosaur that was also found in northeastern China.
And that was Eosinopteryx brevipenna.
Big name little dinosaurs.
That's, I know, these little dinosaurs have long names. Right. But sometimes fossils may point paleontologists in the wrong direction, because there, in the 1970s, there were bones discovered from a tiny, tiny little dinosaur that was, and it was so small that researchers named it Musaurus, which means mouse lizard. However, years later, paleontologists found fossils of giant Musauruses, and they figured out that the first fossils were not a teeny tiny dinosaur, but they were actually babies. Right. And that adults could weigh up to 250 pounds.
Perhaps not the biggest dinosaur to roam Earth, T. T-Rex still loomed large during the Cretaceous period, and paleontologists have found evidence the Lizard King had a cousin that was perhaps just as fierce. Here to discuss the finding with us is Live Science Associate Editor Laura Gagel. Hi, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. So can you tell us a little bit about the discovery of this T-Rex cousin?
Yeah, so this dinosaur has a fantastic name. The Latin name is Thanatotheristes degretorum, and its genus name basically means reaper of death. So a fierce name to fit a fierce dinosaur.
And that is a mouthful.
Yeah. So the way that this dinosaur was discovered is actually a Canadian couple, John and Sandra Degroot of Hayes, Alberta, were walking along a river, and they found a piece of skull. So they told the Royal Tyrrell Museum in Alberta about the discovery, and paleontologists came out and found two skulls of this newfound dinosaur. They didn't know at the time it was newfound. They just put it in their collections. And then a student came along who was doing a project on tyrannosaurs, and he looked at the skull and he said, "This doesn't look familiar to me. I think this is a new species that we don't know about." So he looked into it, and
so what didn't look familiar, or what was so distinct about it?
So it had these very prominent ridges on its upper snout between its eyes and its on the tip of its snout, and they don't know what these ridges were for. Maybe it had to do with how the skin or the scales were connected to this dinosaur. They're probably, maybe they'll learn about it one day, but yeah, this characteristic really stood out. No other dinosaur has these ridges quite like the Reaper of Death does.
The question on my mind is, why did they name it the Reaper of Death?
Yeah, so like other tyrannosaurs, this dinosaur had serrated teeth that were very conical, so quite the terrifying dinosaur. Actually, this is the first tyrannosaur to be named by a graduate student, so he and his colleagues had a little bit of fun with this name.
Totally. And how would this dinosaur have compared to its cousin, T-Rex?
The Reaper of Death lived about 12 million years before T-Rex, so the two never met. But it was a little bit smaller. So this dinosaur, its skull was about 3 feet long, which is about 80 centimeters, and it was about 26 feet long from snout to the tip of its tail. And in contrast, T-Rex was 40 feet long from snout to tail, so substantially larger. But yeah, they're related. It's so fascinating to find a new tyrannosaur dinosaur. This is the first tyrannosaur dinosaur to be discovered in northern North America in 50 years.
Oh, wow. So if it didn't live alongside T-Rex, did it live alongside any dinosaurs that scientists know about?
Yeah, actually. So the formation it was discovered in isn't well known for dinosaur finds, but they have found two other kinds of dinosaurs there, both plant eaters. One is a relative of Triceratops, and the other is a Pachycephalosaur. Those are the dinosaurs with the helmet-like heads. And given that they were herbivores, there's a good chance that the Reaper of Death chowed down on them when it was hungry.
Oh, wow. So how does this dinosaur compare to other tyrannosaurs that have been found in North America?
They actually found something really interesting. So they only found the skull for this dinosaur, but the skull actually tells them quite a lot. Its snout is quite long and deep. And other dinosaurs from northern North America, which include Canada and Montana and like the northern states of the U.S., have a similar head shape. But when you go further south, like Utah, they have more of a bulldog-like face. It's kind of shorter. And it appears that there are these two distinct populations of tyrannosaurs in North America. And they're not quite sure why, if there was some kind of geographical thing separating them, or they just kind of stayed in their own neck of the woods. But
right.
It does appear that they are very distinct morphologically.
Oh, that's interesting. So I've been talking with Laura Gagel, Associate Editor at Live Science. You can check out her article, Reaper of Death, Newfound Cousin of T-Rex Discovered in Canada, on Live Science. The link is in the show notes. Thanks so much, Laura.
Thanks.
When we talk about paleontology, we generally think about digging up bones like the Reaper of Death, T-Rex cousin that we spoke with Laura about. But there are some scientists who have broached the seemingly far-fetched idea of bringing dinosaurs back to life.
What?
Yeah. So today's last mystery, is it possible to clone a dinosaur?
All right. So assuming that scientists would want to clone a dinosaur, regardless of whether it's a good idea or not, which, you know, I think we have all of the Jurassic Park movies to basically explain why that would be a terrible idea.
Bad idea.
And also the fact that we have so many dinosaurs around already.
Enjoy the dinosaurs flying around.
Why can't people just enjoy the dinosaurs we have? Okay. But what if let's say we wanted to clone a dinosaur, what would one need?
DNA, obviously. So the instructions for all life on Earth and, you know, like in our cells, DNA was in every cell in a dinosaur's body.
So, okay, so why don't we just get some dinosaur DNA?
Problem is nobody has actually recovered confirmed, verified dinosaur DNA. And it's not that they haven't found any DNA. Bone is a particularly good preserver of DNA. It's sort of the mineral in bone acts as a sort of magnet for the DNA molecule. So it's more likely that it would be in there. But the issue is verifying where the DNA came from.
Right. So you find a fossil and there's DNA in it, but it could be DNA from, you know, anything that came into contact with that bone after the dinosaur died.
So one way to verify the DNA from, you know, looking at those bones and to sort of separate what's dinosaur and what's not is to look to living relatives. Only the theropods like T-Rex, as we've been talking about, have living relatives, which are birds.
Right. Okay. So that method wouldn't work at all for any of the extinct.
Exactly.
Any of the extinct dinosaurs that are not related to birds at all. Okay. So stepping a little outside reality, if we could verify dinosaur DNA, then what happens next?
So like all molecules, DNA starts to decay as soon as a dinosaur dies. So another issue is, would this DNA be in good shape? And the oldest DNA that paleontologists have ever found, ever recovered from any animal, is from horse remains that were 700,000 years old.
Okay. Considering that the non-avian dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, that's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. And so dinosaur DNA, the longest DNA might survive is 5 to 6 million years, which is not 66 million years.
Right. Okay. So now, of course, Jurassic Park introduced the idea that amber can trap and preserve soft tissues. And, you know, could amber potentially preserve a mosquito that had drunk from a dinosaur so that, you know, there was still a meal of, like, you know, liquid blood in the stomach
or perfect conditions coming together.
Right. Or there might still be viable DNA in that blood inside the mosquito. Is that at all possible?
So paleontologists have thought about this. And there was one study on stingless bees found preserved in amber. And that study suggests that DNA does not preserve well in amber.
Okay. So amber might be good at preserving the soft tissue, but not DNA, not viable DNA. So then, for the sake of argument, let's just say that that's researchers somehow found found dinosaur DNA, fully sequenced dinosaur DNA. So then what happens?
So in order to clone a dinosaur in this hypothetical world and this virtual experiment we're doing, scientists would then take that nuclear DNA, which is in the nucleus of all cells, and they'd put it into an egg cell of a related creature in this case, because we don't have any living non-avian dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that egg would then be stimulated to divide until it reaches certain maturity. Mm-hmm. And then scientists would have to find an appropriate surrogate. So you have this egg cell with the dinosaur DNA inside and it's dividing. Then they need to put this egg cell somewhere, a surrogate.
Could you just put it under a chicken?
Well, so a bird, that's a great idea, but it's still a far cry from a T-Rex or a Triceratops. And one scientist pointed out that a lot of the development of an embryo is dictated by the signals from the mother's body.
Okay, so you take that out of the mix, and then you can't be sure that the embryo is going to develop as it would if it were under normal circumstances. So all right. So if we're continuing this hypothetical thread, let's say that scientists found a suitable host for the dinosaur bird embryo and it developed successfully. Would this creature would be some hybrid of dinosaur and modern bird? Could it survive?
Yeah, that's the question, and that's also something that paleontologists do not really have any hope in, because, you know, you have this half bird, half dinosaur creature, and maybe it was viable to give birth, but in terms of surviving and all of these different systems working together in a living creature, that just is very far-fetched, and scientists are not so hopeful that this animal would even survive after birth.
And yet scientists have taken some steps along that route just to test parts of this,
they have.
Haven't they? Yeah. How did that go?
So a paleontologist from Montana State University, Jack Horner, he leads up a project which is called the Chickenosaurus Project.
Of course it is.
And the aim is to create a dinosaur-like chicken.
Okay,
so it's not cloning exactly, but, you know, we're getting there.
So how do you turn a chicken into something like a dinosaur?
Well, they're trying to do this sort of in piecemeal. So to turn a chicken into a dinosaur-like creature, they're doing it with certain features. They're doing it one feature at a time. They'd have to give this chicken teeth and a long tail, and then they'd have to revert its wings back to arms and hands.
Right. So this is actually what some of the earliest birds
exactly
would have looked like.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So in 2015, scientists did clear one hurdle. They turned chicken beaks into dino snouts. But that feat took them 7 years just to, you know, this one feature.
Right. So then what does that mean for the process of being able to go, you know, full dino chicken?
So Jack Horner says that his team is about 50% there for the full dino chicken. And so next, his group is working on giving a chicken a long tail. And he even agrees that this is probably the most complex part about making a dinosaur chicken. And then would the tail work? So even if they could create the feature, you know, get the embryo to develop a tail, the brain would also have to sort of rewire itself so the animal could use this feature or any of these features.
Right. That's the thing about evolution is that these physical features, they don't just sort of appear by themselves. There are genetic connections that scientists may not be aware of where certain features are connected to certain other features. And then there's the whole question of, you know, how the animal actually manages and controls these physical traits, and which is something that is not being addressed because scientists are only looking at how to physically change parts
exactly
of the animal one piece at a time.
Exactly. But, you know, Jack Horner had this great quote about this Chickenosaurus, and besides getting there to a dino chicken, he said that it's about answering the biggest question of all. And a quote from him is that any of us that have any curiosity about how we all got here and where everything came from has to be interested in evolutionary biology. It's basically the blueprint of life on this earth. So I like that he's taking this approach. I mean, it's a wild idea, but the way his perspective on it, I think, is pretty interesting.
And it's not just dinosaurs. Actually, there's been a lot of talk in scientific circles in over recent decades about the possibility of bringing back an animal that did live much more recently than dinosaurs, and that's the woolly mammoth.
Right, right. And so would it be easier to clone a mammoth than a dinosaur? You know, they were around, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, we had woolly mammoths on Earth. And in fact, scientists woke up cells from a 28,000-year-old woolly mammoth mummy named Yuka, and that was found in Siberia. And they put nuclei with DNA from the woolly mammoth into mouse eggs. And that process activated the mammoth chromosomes so that actual biological reactions could happen. And they found that those biological reactions were carried out during cell division.
Mm-hmm. But that was as far as it went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That all came to a halt. And so they think that, so the idea is that an egg is supposed to fix any damaged DNA so that cell division can start and continue. And that seems to not have happened. And perhaps there was too much damage to the DNA for the egg to fix it.
Mm-hmm. And then there have been other efforts to recreate woolly mammoths that involve elephants?
Yes. So George Church, who is at Harvard and MIT, he heads up a project called the Harvard Woolly Mammoth Revival. And his team is using something called CRISPR, which is a gene editing technique. It's sort of like scissors. They can cut out little splices of DNA and put different DNA into the chain. And he is using that to insert woolly mammoth genes into the DNA of Asian elephants.
Right. So this would create something that's not a woolly mammoth so much as a mammoth-elephant hybrid of some kind.
Exactly. And, you know, as we sort of alluded to earlier, this is controversial. You know, conservationists say that why spend all these resources to bring back these huge animals when we have plenty of threatened and endangered animals right here alive on Earth that we could be, you know, putting resources into saving. Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's dinosaur mysteries are birds dinosaurs, what were the world's biggest and smallest dinosaurs, and is it possible to clone a dinosaur, are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in the podcast notes.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally, it'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.